we're agnostic to where you come in at. It's not a deficit-based mentality. It's not, oh, you're 3 years behind some made-up idea of a human. You're just at where you're at. Let's embrace that, and then let's talk about how we grow from here. And let's celebrate that.
Welcome to Learning Unboxed, a conversation about teaching, learning, and the future of work. I'm your host and chief goddess of the PASS Foundation, Annalise Corbin. We know the current model for education is obsolete. It was designed to create fleets of assembly line workers, not the thinkers and problem solvers needed today. We've seen the innovations that are possible within education, and it's our goal to leave the box behind and reimagine what education can look like in your own backyard. Welcome to today's episode of Learning Unboxed. As always, I'm excited to talk with another great innovator in a transformative education space. And joining us today is Dr. Tyler Thigpen, co-founder and CEO of The Forest School. So Tyler, welcome to Learning Unboxed.
Thanks, Annalise. It's great to be here.
Excellent. Tyler and I had the opportunity to bump into each other at a shared conference where I had the privilege of getting to listen to him chat with us about just the amazing learner-centered environments that he's had the privilege to be involved with, create, lead, really amazing stuff. And so just to set a little bit of context for our listeners, the Forest School is a 21st century micro school, grades pre-K through 12, with learner-driven technology, Socratic discussions, hands-on projects, and real-world apprenticeships in an intentionally diverse and character-foraging community. At the Forest School, children are trusted and empowered to be responsible for their own learning and to use their learning to change the world, something we all need this next generation to do. Their learner-centered-driven community puts children at the center of their learning, allowing them to create and maintain personal goals, relational covenants, and real-world meaningful work. All fabulous things. So Tyler, anytime I get the chance to talk with a fellow founder, the first question I always ask is, what were you thinking? Why do this? Because it's so much work. Being a founder and starting a new endeavors, holy moly, it's an epic effort. It's a huge lift. It's an incredibly powerful for many founders, but it's not without a lot of thinking. It's not without a lot of hindsight. And so let's just set the stage. Like, why do this thing when you did it?
It is hard. It is a lot of work. I resonate with you. For me, multiple components to why, but it's been a labor of love. I have four children. And what might it look like to help be a part of something that created a learning environment for them that got as close as possible to the sort of learning experiences that I wanted them to enjoy? What also would be a learning environment that would really push the conversation forward in our state of Georgia and in our nation and really move away from the industrial age model of schooling and towards something that's way more empowering, that's way more interesting, that's way more engaging. I grew up and moved all around the southeastern corner of the United States myself as a child, and was exposed to a lot of different learning environments. And because I moved around so much, didn't really have deep, long-lasting connections with people for more than a year or two until I really settled down in Atlanta. And the longer I have been in this work, the more I have come to appreciate the fact that there are a lot of young people who are maybe suffering from sort of a poverty of isolation. They don't have a ton of caring adult supports around them, maybe just one or two, but not a whole network like I did. I remember, Annalise, when I was 12 years old, my parents told me if I wanted to buy a car when I was 16, I would have to pay for it. And so I started my own lawn business called Executive Lawn Care. And I cut grass. And sure enough, I had $5,500 by the time I was 16. And I bought the best car I've ever had, a black 1989 Chevrolet Blazer. And, you know, for a while, I looked at that and I was like, look at me. I worked so hard. I did such a good job. But the older I've gotten, the more I've seen, wow, I had a ton of help. My parents, you know, lent me my mower. My clients trusted a middle schooler rather than a professional lawn care. My grandfather taught me how to save money. I even got the idea from a friend. You know, I had social capital. I had practical help that emerged from trusting, caring relationships. And So I'm very motivated by how do we create environments that surround kids with multiple caring adults where they can get the kind of help that they need. And as I've come to appreciate education research, I think that's the greatest predictor of academic success is actually the strength and quantity and depth of one's relationships. And so it's how do we do that for my kids? How do I do that for kids around here and maybe be a model for others?
We see the exact same thing, right? You know, at the end of the day, the most successful kids, when you really sort of dig in and you talk with them or you interview them, take your pick, the thing that they will tell you is the kids that are happy and engaged and are thriving, they will cite all of these adults that were just there to be part of the journey, not to necessarily lead them, not to tell them what to do, but to literally go on the journey with them. And it is incredibly powerful. I'm super curious then, outside of the sort of formal, here's what the Forest School endeavor is, when you really think about the working nuts and bolts of what you've created, what does that look like for you? What's the magic sort of sauce outside of, you know, having a lot of adult interaction and support in the space? But what does it look and feel like if you're a kid in that space?
Well, I'll couch it in terms of what it means to be human. I think as humans, we all have feelings, we all have thoughts, and we all have plans. And they're coming from a beautiful, ancient, some might say sacred space. And the design of most learning environments, I think, kind of shuts those down. There's really not a lot of space and time that kids can devote to those things. But what we're doing every day here at Forest is really trying to create a space, an opportunity for kids to identify and express their feelings, to think all and share all their thoughts, and to consider other perspectives and potentially change their mind, and to make their plans every day. So I think at the heart of it, you've got a learning environment from, you know, 8 to 3:15 where learners are making plans and they're living into those plans and they're learning as a result, both the positive and the failures or challenges that they need to. And that looks and feels different ways. And to achieve that, we have guides instead of teachers, you know, where our staff don't answer questions or explain things, but rather employ the Socratic method to really invite deep thinking and goal setting. We have mixed staged studios instead of classrooms where learners are together with multiple different ages and can learn from all sorts of kind of people. We don't have grades. Instead, we have mastery based badges, kind of like the scouts, you know, so that learners can choose how they want to demonstrate mastery of certain things. And so there's not one correct right or wrong answer, but there's many different ways to get at, you know, what mastery could look like. And then also, like, the learners make the rules. So they're following rules that they've made. And of course, our caring adults are overseeing the process to make sure it's not unjust or discriminatory, but just a lot of questions, very little lecture, if any. No homework, actually. And then there's a lot of learners kind of going at their own pace, going as fast or as slow as they want without judgment. And then lastly, you know, some real world projects and some apprenticeships where learners are being given opportunities to actually do something in our community. You know, use your math, use your science, use your English, use your language arts to help, for example, the mayor and the city council build golf cart paths or help Fun Spot America down the road to design their new roller coaster or help our neighborhood Trillith to design a garden, you know, real stuff.
Yeah.
And then to apprentice alongside of professionals. But it all goes back to a space of, you know, letting them express, explore, develop their thoughts, feelings, and plans.
Absolutely. And kids thrive in that environment. Yeah, it's the best. So just to make sure that our listeners really sort of have a grounded understanding. So what's the size, the scope and scale, I guess? This is a micro school. So by design, right, it's not going to be huge. And how does it fit within the structure of public or private education within Georgia? Just to make sure that everybody understands what we're really talking about here.
Absolutely. So we are an independent, diverse by design school, pre-K 4 through 12. It's 155 learners. And when I say diverse by design, we really spent a lot of time and effort building a diverse pipeline of families to consider the school. So economic diversity, racial, age, gender, learning differences, religion and school background. About a quarter of our kids come from charter schools, a quarter come from traditional district schools, a quarter from traditional private schools, and a quarter from homeschool environments. It's a really interesting mix. And about 52% are families of color, about 30% are families on scholarship, and around 20, maybe 18% are learners with either an IEP or a psych eval. And, you know, a lot of leaders in our space, when they think about scale, they think about, you know, more schools or more children. We don't think about it that way. We do have an online school that we launched during COVID, and it's, you know, got kids from all four US time zones, Kenya, Uganda, Costa Rica, Mexico. Our head of schools in Thailand, and then other staff are all over the states, different states. But our version of scale is our Institute for Self-Directed Learning. And through that, we have a research agenda where we're putting out research on self-directed, learner-led, learner-driven, self-determined spaces and how to do those well and with fidelity and with efficacy. And then we also partner with public school districts and charter networks to move away from teacher-centric models to more learner-driven, learner-led models. And so we do a lot of leadership training and consulting around that. That's our organization in short.
Yeah. And all of those elements are necessary as it relates to just really creating the momentum for change, right? And that's one of the conversations that we certainly have at PAST an awful lot and within and around our community about thinking about the shifting of the educational ecosystem or ecosystems, right? Those sets of systems that come and interplay that just aren't working for, you know, lots of our learners. And yet still within some of these traditional systems, there's a lot of really amazing things that are happening, but they're happening in pockets. It's not connected. It's not something that sort of really moves the needle across big groups of students. So I am really curious, Tyler, when you sort of think about the work that's happening and the experiences in particular of the learners, where do you feel like you see the greatest synergies that are happening amongst the students, right? Because one of the things that I love about these smaller school environments that are really learner driven is that it's interesting to sort of watch and map the ways that the ecosystem sort of shifts through time of its own momentum, right? Because when you shift into that sort of learner driven space, anything can happen, right? The wheels can come off, right? In some endeavors. But oftentimes what happens is the students, they're driving their own force for change, right? And I'm really curious from you about sort of where you sort of see that happening in your environment.
I appreciate that question, Annalise. And your previous comment made me appreciate as well your, when you introduce the Learning Unboxed podcast, you sort of introduce and say, hey, we know, you know, the ship has sailed, that the industrial age model is no longer relevant and ideal. And I appreciate this question because it's like, all right, in our version of, you know, trying to build the future of learning, where are there these moments of power, of potential, of promise that may be set apart than the traditional environments? And you're making me think of a few. One of them would be before what we call an exhibition. Exhibition is basically a public meeting where learners lead it. And this is, you know, ages 4 through 18. And they're leading their parents, they're leading other learners, they're leading visitors to the school, and they are demonstrating their learning or doing some performance task or, you know, presenting their work or product to a client. There's a moment before that happens that's kind of a powerful moment among the learners because they're working in teams and in groups where they really roll up their sleeves and next level assume responsibility for shared work in a way that doesn't regularly happen, I think, in the industrial age model of schooling. And it just feels like a powerful moment. It feels like ownership. It feels like excitement, nervousness, and it's kind of a rush for the learners. And, you know, when it's over, they're glad they did it. So that's one moment. I think another is when learners are in our environment long enough and they're not entering into us already self-determined or self-directed and driving their own learning. And yet at some point with us, they have an aha moment. They realize, oh, this really is on me.
Yeah.
It's my responsibility to learn. And sometimes that happens, you know, privately, individually, and they realize that. just with enough time and experience, they finally make sense of the fact that we, the adults, are not making them, mm-hmm. you know, and we are in fact respecting and honoring them to set their own goals, and that we're going to get behind those. And finally, they're like, oh, they really do. This is on me. Or sometimes it happens in small groups where honestly, they'll probably cheat their way. They'll cut corners and take shortcuts just to get stuff done and complete things, but they're not really going for mastery. That is a shelf life though. And until they experience something where they're like, oh, I actually should have learned that and I should have taken responsibility and now I'm having to pay for it. Oh crap.
Yeah.
You know, and often that happens in a group setting. And sometimes learners will blame and they'll point the finger, you know, at others or at the school. But most of the time or often, you know, they'll be like, wow, this was my choice and I'm experiencing natural consequences of my choices and I'm going to all of a sudden step up and learn this thing on my own at a way that's next level. And then I think two more quick moments that are powerful for us. You know, one is just any time a learner sets and articulates their own goals that are in alignment with their values and alignment with their selves, that's powerful. And when they share those in the context of relationships, that feels powerful. And then the other one is because we're a small environment, when they fight and when they conflict with each other, you know, they realize who they are able to build trust with and who they're not able, unfortunately, to build trust with, but yet they still have to learn to live together with them in this environment. That's really powerful. And those moments for me are some of the more ethereal, existential, like, there's a lot happening in those moments that can't be described with words or on paper or in a slideshow.
Right.
But the learning is so deep.
Are you ready to join the movement to revolutionize education? Stay tuned for the full unveiling of my forthcoming book, Hacking School, 5 Strategies to Link Learning to Life, where we'll dive deeper into these topics and unlock key strategies to educational transformation. If you want to stay in the know, sign up for notifications at pastfoundation.org/hackingschool. You know, I really, truly appreciate those examples, Tyler, because I've seen and we see at the Innovation Lab here at PASS a lot of those same types of things, those same behaviors, right? And I love the fact that you have the sort of public demonstration of learning element built into the work that you're doing. And because kids do, their confidence grows, they understand why that's important, their abilities to articulate what they've learned, what they're interested in, the directions they want to go, those are incredibly powerful tools. But I also appreciate that it's not perfect every day, right? And that the learners along the way, right, they're not just learning content, they're learning about self. They're learning who they are, they're learning what they want to be, where they want to imagine themselves, and they have to work through that. And I think that's one of the things the traditional education system has really lost sight of, is we're talking about the entirety of humans. So we can't just dedicate our time, energy, and effort to one small piece of that human. We have to embrace the entire of humanity. And my listeners have heard me say this a million times before. One of the things that, you know, I love about this work is the fact that when we truly empower kids and we have confidence and faith in their ability to rise to the occasion, whatever that happens to be, that they will often exceed all expectations, including their own, right? And there's so much value and power in that experience, right? You know, so I love all of those elements. And I appreciate that it hasn't been a flawless journey.
Not at all. Not at all. And I mean, similar for you, Annalisa, I mean, I love the title that PASS has, the Innovation Lab. I mean, it invites the failure, you know?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And I don't know what your leadership style is. Mine has evolved to become, you know, full transparency about the challenges and the failures that we have at a leadership level, at an organizational level, at a systems processes level, the challenges that we've spent a lot of time over the years documenting, observing and documenting and sharing the struggles, common struggles that learners have, the common struggles that parents and caregivers have, the common struggles that our guides, our staff, our admin leadership team have. So we're all aware, you know, I mean, the caveat to that is anything that's legal that can't be, you know, divulged, but folks are going to know what issues we think there are based on what evidence and what we're doing to address those. And we've discovered, we're not discovered, we've experienced that that has helped us build trust with our families and our learners, to just name the fact that it's not perfect, because nothing is.
Right. And we don't want it to be perfect. I mean, I would argue, right? That's my opinion. But I would argue that we don't want it to be perfect, because we desperately need our learners to experience failure, experience success, experience joy, experience anguish, right? And to recognize that that's just part of living life on planet Earth, right?
That's right.
And because without that, we are not going to be creative. We're not going to tap into our passions that can somehow not only fulfill us individually, but potentially be a career, be a benefit to the rest of humanity and to the environment. Take your pick, right? But I don't think that learners can walk out of a traditional experience without having had the opportunity to practice, if you will. I often will talk about the grace of the space, right? What it has to offer to us when we hold space to be able to learn and to engage in all of those elements of that process.
I love that. And you're reminding me, at our last exhibition before the culmination of our 2023-2024 school year, we had all of our learners together and we invited them to consider, you know, on a scale of 1 to 5, share with your parents or caregivers how hard you feel like you worked this year. And, you know, we've created a culture, hopefully, where they'll be honest, you know. And so they shared that. And I sort of went around and we were like, hey, you know, if you said 4 or 5, I hope you feel proud of yourself. You know, if you said 1, 2, or 3, you know, at this point in the year, you've experienced the natural consequences, you know, of some of those choices. Our invitation is to consider reflecting on that and why you chose to show up that way. Now, regardless of what your number is, you need to know and never forget that we love and accept you, and that you are welcome here, and that we're excited that we know you. I think what y'all do and what we're trying to do, creating an environment where they can experience and learn from their choices in a safe, low stakes, supportive environment is just so instructive, you know, for their character, and will have hopefully positive ripple effects through the rest of their lives.
It absolutely will, right? Because it's just an amazing journey. And, you know, like you, we've got to spend lots of time with these kiddos and we watch just the amazing things that they go on to do and their contribution back into sort of the local ecosystem. That makes me so joyful. You know, I mentioned as we just were getting ready to start that right now we're in the throes of our sort of summer experience. And one of the reasons I love it so much is because the kids who came to us really, really young, right? Who they may not be in our environment day in and day out because they go to school other places, but they come and they join us in the summer. And some of them will show up like second grade. And I now have some of those kids, second, third, fourth graders who came, who are now either finishing up high school or have just recently finished or they're early college. They're coming back and they're teaching the same programs, right, that they went through way back when, but with their own twist and their own flair and their own expertise added into them, because we're like, here's the generalized gist of this. What do you want it to be? You've lived it. Now come back and lead it.
So great. So great. It's funny you say that. I'm actually looking out the window right now at our school. We've got a summer camp going on, and one of our graduates from 3 years ago is one of the camp counselors.
See? It's the best, right?
So good. So good.
Yeah. Yeah. So good. You know, if you don't mind, one of the topics that you mentioned earlier, I'd really love to sort of dig in just a little bit, pick your brain, because I get questions about mastery all the time. We, like you, advocate for mastery as part of the work that we do. But lots of folks really, really struggle with mastery. As educators, they struggle with how to make that transition. As students, as we know, especially if they're coming out of a more traditional assessment system, this whole idea of mastery is just a bit mind-blowing to them. And yet, once they really get the gist of it, they tend to love it. So how do you help? Let's start with the student side. How do you help students get mastery and get to embrace mastery and see it as an opportunity as opposed to something that I just can't quite wrap my brain or my experiences around?
I'll give you 3 tangible things. It's a great, I think, wicked question that is so relevant in our sector today. One is, and this is more abstract and for leaders, but it's what kind of academic growth we're actually measuring and celebrating. You know, there's three different kinds. You got longitudinal, comparative, and absolute, right? Absolute being, hey, this is how much a learner has achieved based upon some external outside standard. Comparative growth, how they do against each other, other kids. And then longitudinal, how they grow over time. I mean, I think in a mastery-based environment, it's just so beneficial when educators and leaders really champion longitudinal growth over time. And they say, hey, we're agnostic to where you come in at. You know, it's not a deficit-based mentality. It's not, oh, you're 3 years behind some made up idea of a human. You're just at where you're at. Let's embrace that. And then let's talk about how we grow from here. And let's celebrate that, you know. And by the way, you're probably going to grow at your own unique pace. And it's our job as educators and leaders and peers to, you know, help you monitor that. And we're going to support you along the way. So I think having that in the water is crucial for this whole mastery conversation. And then practically, I'll just name two things. One would be a tool and one is a signature learning experience. The tool is single point rubrics. We love them. I don't know if your listeners are familiar with single point rubrics, but instead of, you know, a traditional rubric where you've got three or four levels, developing, proficient, advanced, accomplished, or whatever, you know, your version might be, a single point rubric has a particular competency defined, maybe 3, 4, or 5 different subcomponents of that definition. And then on one column, it's simply what is going awesome about that. And then on the other column, it's what needs improvement is an area of growth. And then just that, you know, so it's not taking a stance in absolute terms about where it's at, but more like at this moment in time, a snapshot of learning against this particular competency, skill, or knowledge. And then let's revisit that single point rubric, you know, a week, a month, a session, a year, whatever, from now to see the kind of growth that's happened. Because hopefully what you see is some of the things that are areas of growth become strengths over time, you know. So I think single point rubrics have been a great tool. And then lastly, the signature learning experience is something we call practicals. If you or your listeners, Annalise, have friends that are firefighters or volunteer firefighters, if you want to get a promotion or a job, you have to do a practical. You have to go before your captains and show what you know, and a performance task and some real live Q&A. And if you fail, it's not the end of the world. You're not done yet. You can come back and do your practical again a few weeks or months from now, but you need to go back and learn some things for sure before you do. Similar in karate, right? When you get your belt, you level up to like an orange belt or a yellow belt or purple belt, whatever, black belt. You've got to go before the senseis and you've got to show what you know and demonstrate your learning. We created a signature learning experience at Forest called Practicals, where learners can bring their own evidence from anywhere in their life, in school, out of school, recent, years ago, to prove that they have understood deeply and mastered certain concepts. And we have a panel of caring adults that kind of put on the employer hat or the college admissions hat and look at the strength of the evidence and then give them feedback on their own evidence that they've come up with. So they have a lot of ownership in what they're sharing with us. And then, you know, give them guidance about what it is they might need to show differently to make the evidence a little bit stronger. Or if it becomes apparent that they haven't learned the thing, then like what signature learning experiences they might create for themselves to more deeply understand whatever the concept is, you know. An example would be like entrepreneurship would be, you know, a practical, and learners bring a pro forma, or they bring a marketing plan that they've made, and they bring a report on a budget and some profits that they've made. And then they have to answer questions about their understanding about passive income and a minimum viable product and what those things are, you know?
Yeah.
And then if they demonstrate mastery, then, you know, they can get credit for that and move on to the next thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I love that very much. Both elements of that. And I appreciate that. Especially I love the single point rubric, right? That is one of the things, man, I push on so hard all the time, right? You know, it's always one of those very first things that when we start working with, you know, schools or our more traditional public districts that are looking to make the shift to a more learner-driven environment. It's like, well, you've got to get rid of this, you know, this notion of, you know, you can get 1 point, you can add 3 points, or you can work towards 5 points. You know, why anything less than mastered, So I love that. So thank you for articulating that. It's perfect. You know, I always like to, Tyler, as I sort of wrap up these conversations, they always seem to fly by. People seem shocked when I was like, ah, we're getting ready to wrap up here. But recognizing that, you know, the folks that are listening are coming from all over the world. They're in different places, not just geographically, but in their own practice and their own way of thinking about teaching and learning within their communities. And they hear us talking about things and elements that they're super intrigued by. And I can imagine many folks thinking, gosh, you know, I come from a really big district, or I'm in a really rural location. I'm in some place where I don't have a lot of flexibility around creating or doing things differently, even within my own individual classroom. So how would I get started doing some of the things that I just heard Tyler talking about? So what would you tell somebody who asked you that question?
I would say we can help. So through our institute, through for self-directed learning, we have, it's a new school models design lab. So I actually, on the side, I teach at the University of Pennsylvania Graduate School of Education and launched a few new school models design labs there that are now housed at our institute. And we've led over 90 different folks to design blueprints for a new learning model. And we've walked through a design process, and this is what I would encourage folks to consider, whether they're doing it for a classroom or they're doing it for a school. There's a world in which, as a designer, if we sort of put on the hat of a design thinker, a learning designer, a design team, especially, where we can, you know, basically identify our portrait of a graduate, the things we want to be true of the folks who leave our learning environment at whatever age they lead our learning environment. Carefully define our mission and objectives, also name the constraints. The power of naming constraints is creativity can happen within constraints.
Absolutely. And so, you can design with those in mind.
Totally, totally. Yes. So it's possible for anybody. Yeah. It's possible for anybody regardless of resources. And they're just going to look different wherever you are. And then once you define those constraints and you've got the portrait of a graduate and the mission, then it's okay. This is the fun part. It's like, all right, what are the signature learning experiences that we need to either like mimic that other schools are doing or take off the shelf and adopt and adapt and make our own or create from scratch so that our learners are getting practice daily at doing, exploring, encountering the things that we say we care about in our portrait of a graduate? And what is their daily stakeholder experience journey look like from 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. or 3 to 5 p.m. or whatever it is that we're doing. So I would just invite them to go on a design journey to either design anew or redesign their learning environment and then start to make pivots towards that. Our institute, you know, like I said, we've got actually an online academy at selfdirect.school where we help folks do that. But you know, there's a lot of great resources online. I'm a founding partner at Transcend, which is a national in the United States R&D firm in education that's got some great online free resources as well. There's a lot of stuff out there.
There really is. But thank you very much for that. Hopefully folks will reach out. Typically they do after these air. So Tyler, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to chat with us. We really appreciate it. And I'm super excited to sort of stay in the know and see what comes next with your work. So we really appreciate you joining us today.
Same. You bet. Well, thank you for, Annalise, your contribution to the movement and interviewing the folks that you have. What an edifying list of topics and speakers that you've identified in your podcast. And I would just put a plug in where we're publishing a book this year, The Playbook for Self-Directed Learning, in the end of 2024 through Routledge Publishing. That'll be out and available. And that's kind of what's next for us. So yeah. I'll share it your way when it comes out.
Absolutely. I saw a little bit, a piece about it. So that's super exciting. So again, thanks so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for Learning Unboxed, a conversation about teaching, learning, and the future of work. I want to thank my guests and encourage you all to be part of the conversation. Meet me on social media at Annalise Corbin and join me next time as we stand up, step back, and lean in to reimagine education.